Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Right now, I have let's call it an advisory for the world out there. Just because we have a pandemic doesn't mean you can't get sick of something else. Right now, the total number of people in the hospital with COVID is extremely low, and that's true of all the hospitals in Santa Cruz. What we do have and are now seeing the disastrous results of is what happens if you decide to stay home and sit out your heart attack because you're afraid of getting exposed to COVID. Well, the answer to that is that you don't get a 21st century heart attack. You get a 1950s heart attack, where what we did when you came in with a heart attack was we put you in bed, put an IV in, gave you some lidocaine, and sat around and waited to see how bad it was. We didn't have stents, we didn't have balloons, we didn't have all of the wonderful technologies that we now have that have turned the old-fashioned myocardial infarction into something we call acute coronary syndrome, because most of the time, if you can get your butt to the hospital within an hour of the onset of symptoms, you aren't going to have an infarction. You're going to have a reversible disease. Now, that should get you thinking that, yeah, I'm going to call 911 and go to the ER if I have crushing substernal chest pain, dyspnea, and shortness of breath. Yeah, you're right. You should. In Italy, where they sat it out, about half of the acute myocardial syndrome patients weren't getting to the hospital at all. And those who did get there were getting there much later. And so they have data from last year, same equivalent week. So in 2020, in March in Italy, they at one hospital, they typically would see 618 in a week at 54 coronary care units it wasn't local. It was actually all of northern Italy. So 54 places, they would see 618 cases. They saw 319. And then as the disease started to withdraw, they started coming out of the woodwork. And what they're finding is a whole lot more heart failure, a whole lot more people with scarred and damaged heart. So what this means, it means if you're really sick, you're really sick and you belong in the hospital, and don't make a poor decision. Don't let your fear of dying of COVID cause you to die of something that is, in fact, probably more likely to kill you. So I'm done beating that one to death. And I just have to comment, shout out to Google. Today, as I was doing my research for the program, I noticed that the Google logo, which changes every day, I love that, it's so cute. Today, all of the letters were little cartoon kind of humanoid figures wearing, wait for it, masks. And every person that I saw while I was running today on the Harkin Slough was either wearing or carrying a mask. Now, it's outside and the wind is blowing, and I noticed when people came close to anybody else, they popped the mask on. I think that's fine. I think that's polite. If someone is running by you or riding a bicycle by you, you do not need to have a mask on. You need to have one with you in case you find yourself under 6 feet from people and in standing air and nothing's happening for a while. Then you need it. If you fell off your bicycle, you'd want to put it on. See what I'm saying? It's about movement. Spoke this morning directly with Gail Newell, the health officer for Santa Cruz County. Some good news and some bad news there, folks. Good news is you really don't need to be wearing a mask while running or bicycling. You just need to have one with you in case you have to stop and be near people. So, good news, you can stop giving each other dirty looks. Let's be kind. Let's develop some gestures, friendly gestures. Wave at everybody. Let's all thumbs up to anyone you see. We are all in this together, and we need to build group solidarity And I want to see us not be a microcosm of let's be mean to each other, because that sometimes somehow makes us bigger. It doesn't. It makes us smaller. More news, not so good from Gail. You will be potentially hearing from your doctor if you test positive. Doctors will be doing some of the contact tracing for lower risk patients. People who are high risk will, of course, be talking to the health department. But you may be getting calls from your doctor's office. You'll definitely be getting packets. I got a look-see at the packets today. And just to clarify, if we are now going to be going with COVID-like syndrome, if a person has suspicious symptoms, and we talked about the loss of smell being an early indicator symptom last week, we're going to ask that person to isolate. We're going to test them, and we're going to isolate them for 10 days since the onset of symptoms. And they have to have an improvement of symptoms and 24 hours afebrile before they go back out into the world. If the person has not, if the person gets tested, it's down for 10 days since the date of the test. And if the person has suspicious symptoms, but you can't get a test result, or until you get a test result, then you're basically isolating too. So you want to keep those masks on so that you aren't a suspicious case. What makes you suspicious? 15 minutes inside with someone who's not wearing a mask, or if someone who is known to be ill coughs or sneezes on you, or if you have a positive contact, and that would be a household member, because obviously that's breaking rule number one. So keep it up, Google, with let's all wear those little masks, and we'll be answering a question about a mask. But before we do that, I want to do a little unmasking of an issue that has gotten more and more complex and more interesting. We're going to try to teach some science and how to read literature, because right now, without peer review, we're all on our own. Some newspaper decides they want a headline grab and they publish something which is tentative and preliminary and not peer reviewed. And we're all scratching our heads wondering, should we believe it? Should we not believe it? Credibility of science is really going downhill right now, but that's because we're in a crisis and people are rushing stuff into publication because they want other people to see it so that they can act on it and replicate it or disprove it. And boy, have we had fun with hydroxychloroquine, starting all the way back to Elon Musk's famous tweet, or was it a retweet? I don't even know. So I'm going to call this little editorial commentary science lesson, timing is everything. Because when we're talking about hydroxychloroquine and looking at the science, this may very well be the truth. Taking it too early or taking it too late may not have any benefit. It's a Goldilocks phenomenon. So for your consideration, I have here a British Medical Journal article from April. This was done in China. It was 60 patients, which is a small number. It was a placebo trial. It was prospective, which means people walked into the hospital and they either went into row A or row B. They had no choice about it. That was a random assignment. All patients who were admitted with COVID were treated if they were in the treatment group. And if they weren't in the treatment group, they weren't treatment. They were not looking at severity of illness. They were just treating all comers that were sick enough to be hospitalized. And what they found was a substantially improved hospital stay, less cough, shorter hospital stay, and none of the 30 in the treatment group went to the ICU, and 4 of the 30 in the placebo group went to the ICU. And the doctors were blinded. Going to the ICU was probably not influenced by the doctor knowing whether or not you were taking hydroxychloroquine. Good study, solid science, needs to replicate. Also, another study, this one from France, you've heard about this one. It was published initially in The Lancet and then also in the British Medical Journal. This was a non-blinded study. They did have a control group that wasn't treated, but they did not give that control group a placebo, and the doctors themselves knew who was who. All of the patients in this group were tested. They were given hydroxychloroquine or not. They were given a daily nasal swab. Daily nasal swab. Boy, do I have swab envy for the French. J'ai envie de ce swab. All right. They showed more rapid clearance of the virus. The study was messy. The sicker patients fell off the study. It was definitely not the world's best science. Got a lot of criticism. Probably wouldn't have been published except we were in a pandemic. Then comes a study from May. This was in the United States. It was in Detroit. They had time to set up a decent study. And this was at the Henry Ford Hospitals in Detroit. It was a large study, 2,500 patients. And it was multiple hospitals. All patients admitted with a diagnosis of COVID-19 were assigned early to receive either placebo or hydroxychloroquine. Mortality was reduced by 66%. So that's a 2/3 reduction in mortality. And it was very statistically significant. So we got some positive things here, but what's coming through to you? Maybe you need to start taking it before you're really, really sick. Let's go to the big splashy JAMA study that caused the United States FDA to withdraw its approval for the use of hydroxychloroquine, except in studies. This was done in New York. It was a retrospective study. That means they were looking back at the records. It was not randomized. They did not have the same protocol. This was just people who went into the hospital and were treated. Any use of hydroxychloroquine counted. And it was not started at the beginning of treatment early on. It was often given as they started to decline and deteriorate. When you look at the criteria, the hydroxychloroquine patients had far more risk factors for severe COVID. They were clearly sicker than the ones who didn't get it, because these were doctors treating patients. These were not doctors doing science. And they had a limited amount of hydroxychloroquine, and they thought it might help, so they gave it to the people who were most likely to die. And they did. There was an increased risk of death in the group that got the hydroxychloroquine. I call that a self-fulfilling prophecy and a clinical error. Another big study, this one was an international study, massive numbers of patients, over 100,000 patients, 671 hospitals. It was published in Lancet in May. It was not randomized. It was very similar to the New York study I've told you about. It was retrospective. And as soon as it was published, it was widely criticized for technical violations and statistical errors, which the people who reviewed it looked at and said, hey, this is not right. This wasn't done correctly. So Lancet actually, in the wake of this study, which did show increased number of death, mostly for cardiac and respiratory failure, in patients who received hydroxychloroquine at some point during their hospitalization, no standardized protocol. Another similar study, basically the same data that got republished in the New England Journal of Medicine, was also retracted shortly after the Lancet retracted theirs. Couple more studies to talk about. A randomized post-exposure prophylaxis study done in United States and Canada. Good science. 800 people who were treated within 4 days of contact with someone with known COVID-19. So within 4 days of close contact, the people that the health department are contact tracing, they were given hydroxychloroquine in a prospective dose to see if it could prevent them from getting sick or seroconverting. 4 days is a little late, given that we know the incubation pattern. So what's interesting about this study is it did not show that there was a benefit, but it also showed a trend towards benefit. So it didn't really disprove either post-exposure prophylaxis or continuous preventative prophylaxis, which I'm not promoting. I'm not promoting doing what Mass Murderer in Chief does. But there was no excess mortality in that group. So what's the take home here? Well, let's talk a little bit about the mechanism of this thing. Why is this even supposed to work? We give it as a medicine for rheumatoid arthritis and other autoimmune disease, which by definition is an overreaction of the immune system inappropriately. Studies that showed and studies that people who take rheumatoid arthritis hydroxychloroquine do not have increased cardiac risk, and they don't get increased cardiac torsade de pointe. They don't get it unless we give them a bunch of other drugs that magnify the effect of the hydroxychloroquine. It's approved for long-term use in this group, and we are not required as doctors to check their EKGs for potential issues because these issues are so rare in healthy or healthy-ish people. Now, the studies that we just talked about that showed benefit were small, but they all had one thing in common. Well, I guess the third one wasn't small. 2,500 is definitely not small. But they all got it early. And I think that makes sense. The negative studies gave it very late to the sicker patients, something we call negative triage. They were not randomized. And the sicker people had a higher risk of death, and more of them died. Doesn't really disprove benefit. What it does prove is that if this is going to work at all, you got to give it early. And it probably does benefit when given early in the course of the disease. So, well, you know, this is going to have an uphill climb, but particularly in the United States. But I think that we need to think about what if it's shown to be beneficial in some more studies? What if it replicates some more? Well, I think we need to save it for the hospitalized patients and also for the poor people with rheumatoid arthritis who are having trouble getting a hold of it. I don't think it's established that we should use it prophylactically. And furthermore, I think using it prophylactically is pretty darn selfish because you're not even sick yet. And if you're taking it away from people who might not die if they get it, like I said, that's pretty darn selfish. We do need to make more of it. I think increasing the supply is very rational based on the data, not on this incredibly politicized news bite understanding that we all have of it if we don't go to the core sources, if we don't go to the data. Maybe if we have a better supply and the rheumatoid people who need it are getting it and the hospitalized people are getting it, then maybe we think about giving it, doing a trial on prophylaxis or early outpatient treatment in people with COVID-like illness who have high risk, like diabetes or lung disease or, you know, other conditions that predispose them to inflammation. That's the group that stands to benefit substantially. And I don't think we want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. So I'm going to take a deep breath. Step off my soapbox. I promised you a conversation about masks, and we're going to our emails. This from Sandra in Santa Cruz, and masks and protective equipment. Dear Dr. Dawn, can you please speak about the variety of choices of masks for the non-medical public? N95 are available now without vent, but also cotton masks in which you insert your own HEPA filter. I've also heard recommendations for the blue-white medical masks under a cloth mask. I'm also considering a mask that has a vent with a carbon filter. I would prefer a vent because even a cloth mask is uncomfortable for me for even a short period of time. I'll email you a picture of this carbon filter, and Sandra in Santa Cruz, I will certainly respond to that email and give you my opinion, but we're going to share a general opinion. And, you know, it's kind of like what I always teach my students around any kind of scientific study. What's the question we're asking? What is our goal? So let's talk about goals here with masks. Are you wearing the mask to protect yourself? And if so, what is the threat level of the situation? Are you wearing the mask to be part of the social contract, which in August of 2020, the social contract is when you're near anybody, you have a mask on of some kind so that your droplets and your little bits of saliva that come out of your mouth when you talk do not get into their airflow. And even a cloth mask, as long as it's dry, and I want to mention that, as long as it's dry, will work for the social contract issue. I personally have different masks for different situations. Because I am a clinician, I'm actively seeing patients in the office, and because I know that were I to become infected, I might not know it for several days, I am always wearing an N95 mask, even when I'm in the room with a well patient doing a physical. I am making sure that I cannot give them anything, and I am also doing a very good job of making sure they can't give me anything. And then we sanitize the surfaces and we go our merry way. I also have a lot of ventilation going because I just like that feeling of the air moving around, diluting out the COVID virus. And I do this test. I did it yesterday in my office. It was very instructive. Which way direction should I place the fans? Which way should they spin? Have I got enough airflow? So I lit a stick of incense and I walked around and I looked at the air currents. I looked where the smoke was going. And wherever the smoke is going, that's where the COVID germs are going to go. And if the smoke is very rapidly disappearing from view, then that means that you've got enough air mixing that's a safer indoor environment than one where the smoke is just kind of lazily going up towards the ceiling and pooling and coming back down the side of the wall. And that'd be a situation where you'd want to open a window. So I recommend the incense test. You could also use a smoky, a candle and then put it out and watch where the smoke goes. But incense, unless you're allergic to it, worked really well. So if I'm visiting a sick person, if I'm treating a patient, if I'm doing an exam in the office, I have got that mask on. And if I'm going to be up close, like an oral exam, I also have a face shield or goggles because you don't want those particles getting into your eyeballs. It's been established. It can attach to the eye and get into the nose through the tear ducts. So surgical masks, the blue and white ones that you've been talking about, this is the best way to protect others from droplets. It's far more effective than a cloth mask. The question is, how effective is it at treating you? Well, because they kind of fit loosely, unless you get the tie-on kind and tie them really tight, some of the side, there's going to be some side leak in front of your ears. So some of your virus, if you were shedding virus, would escape sideways. But people wouldn't be getting a blast in the face, and it wouldn't travel very far. And a lot of that is that when we cough, sneeze, or laugh, things leave our mouth with a fairly high velocity, and they can travel like 4 feet. So with even the cloth mask, that's prevented unless it's wet. What I like is the surgical mask with a cloth mask tied tightly over it. And what that does is it presses it against my nose and mouth so I know that I'm not endangering anybody. And it's the two layers, the cloth and the surgical mask, are going to stop a lot of droplets. They won't be completely bomb-proof, but if it does get through, it's a smaller amount that's going to get through, and a smaller amount is much less likely to make me sick. There is definitely a threshold effect with this stuff. So a good compromise for a higher risk indoor situation where everyone is masked, but some of them are wearing a gaiter and the gaiter's not all that good. It's a good compromise. But basically, if you're in a situation where you're in an indoor space and people are not wearing masks or are real close to each other and real close to you, you want to pull that one folded, you want to excuse yourself, go to the ladies' room, pull out that N95 mask and put your cloth mask over it. No one's going to notice that you switched. And you won't be talking very much. You'll be sitting there and nodding politely and trying to figure out a way how to get out of this dangerous social situation without whatever reason was keeping you there, like it's your boss and you have to be here. And it's like, oh, you know, I'm just going to keep my mask on. I think I might be getting sick. And people will probably cut you will probably be very happy if you keep your mask on in that setting. So a little white lie, maybe, if you're really stuck. But don't be in a closed space with people who aren't wearing masks unless you live with them, and then you're all in trouble anyway if one of them gets sick. I think it's good if you're over 50 to have at least one N95 mask, and you can get a decent one for under $10, and they're available now in the stores. You can even get them locally. It's outrageous price, but if you're only going to buy one and you're going to save it for these emergencies, then that's actually pretty good. Cloth mask. So the cloth mask, carry that when you're running, walking outdoors. Put it on if you have to stop to talk with a neighbor, and please do socially distance in that situation. The valves release your air and make the mask more comfortable, but they do partially defeat the prospect of protecting others. And the filter, the charcoal filter, is going to keep your droplets out, but you will maybe shed some virus into the atmosphere, so you've lowered the quality of the protection that you offer in the social contract. I have no data on carbon versus HEPA filters, but whatever you're using, your nose and mouth must be fully covered, and the mask really needs to be tight and pressed against your face. So if you're really looking to protect yourself and others, that's what you need to do. Take a mirror, like a hand mirror, and blow out and see if you fog the mirror at the side of the mask in front of your ear. If you do, then you need to tie it tighter because you're still shedding. We're going to go to our caller. That is Evan in Santa Cruz. Evan, are you there?
All right, great. Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure. What can we talk about?
It's about heart disease. Wondering if you're familiar with Caldwell Esselstyn and his claims that heart disease can be reversed. He has his patients 6 times a day eat vegetables high in nitric oxide in order to create better blood flow in the arteries. And I'm just curious how you feel about that.
Well, I'd want a definition of the term reversed. And of course, heart disease isn't one disease. So where I think that could be really helpful would be in chest pain called angina, which we treat with nitroglycerin, which increases nitric oxide in the blood vessels. So what you're doing effectively when you eat beets and other high nitrate vegetables is you are increasing the amount of nitrogen that's available to be turned into nitric oxide. And I use that technique, celery as well, for blood vessel relaxation for natural management of hypertension. Another thing that works along that same line is L-arginine, and I don't know if he talks about that because I haven't been to his website, but this also gooses the enzyme that makes nitric oxide. You see, as we get older, our blood vessels get a little less efficient at making nitric oxide. And nitric oxide is what relaxes the muscle after adrenaline has caused it to tighten up. So normally you get a blast of adrenaline from the adrenal gland. It causes a contraction of the blood vessels because there are adrenergic receptors that tighten up the blood vessels. But then the blood vessel itself, being an organ, not a passive pipe, goes, oh, no, we don't want that pressure right here. We're going to open that cardiac vessel up right now because we just had an adrenaline flush. And we want it open and big because the heart's going to start beating now, and we want to be sure we feed the muscle some oxygen and some sugar. And as the blood vessel wall gets old and cranky, it doesn't make the same amount of nitric oxide. It gets sluggish, and that's why you see things like hypertension showing up in older age primarily. So I think it could work. I think that if we're talking about someone who's had a heart attack and they have congestive heart failure because they've got dead muscle, I'm not expecting much from my beets here. You know, that's a structural problem, and that's not a heart disease I think it would reverse. So I hope that clarifies it.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you for your question. Very interesting one. Keep listening and have a great day. Stay safe, though, okay?
Thank you. Bye.
Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Dunn. I am so happy I tuned in. I've been forgetting about your show, like since you changed over to this wonderful new station. And today I was like, I've got to listen. And I can't believe you started the show with exactly what I wanted to know about, because the hydrochloroquine, I'm saying it right, issue has become so politicized. And I've been trying to really figure it out. So I was just so grateful for that. And I'm going to share the info. I wondered one thing. I thought it was in the Ford study, but maybe I saw somewhere else where people are talking about that it's a great drug, but only used with zithromycin and zinc in addition. Have you seen those studies? I don't know. You know, I've just seen that frequently.
Yeah, I have seen the azithromycin, and the zinc is something I've been recommending since the onset of the pandemic, because, among other things, zinc and vitamin A increase the amount of antibodies you have in your nose that attack all coronaviruses. Mm. So it's your body's already seen a coronavirus and it can already attack it. And that type of antibody is increased by taking a vitamin A and taking zinc. So how much? 50 milligrams of zinc, maybe 24,000 units of vitamin A, but not if you might get pregnant or are pregnant, because it will cause birth defects at that dose.
Does it matter if it's the animal version or beta carotene?
It should be vitamin A, but you can get vitamin A that's synthetic, that's vegan. It's not all animal derived.
That's really interesting, because I have been taking zinc all along, but didn't know about the beta carotene. And as far as in combination with the hydrochloroquine and the zithromycin, I think I'm
okay. Yeah, getting back to your original question. So, yeah. The original study did not include zinc, and that was the French Didier Roualt study, and also there was a study in China that I mentioned that just used hydroxychloroquine and didn't use azithromycin. So when they added the azithromycin, the logic was that it would help prevent bacterial pneumonia, which is a secondary complication when you get a deep viral pneumonia. Among other things that get wiped out, your ability to fight and clear bacteria from your lungs gets severely compromised. And we just had a hurricane in New York, and there aren't any trash trucks taking away garbage cans right now. And so that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Your trash collectors don't take out the garbage because they got knocked out by the virus, and now you get a secondary bacterial pneumonia. And the azithromycin has a interesting property. It gets into the white blood cells, so it migrates to the source of the infection and has a prolonged effect. So the only problem and downside with the erythromycin is that in some individuals, it may increase the toxicity of the hydroxychloroquine. Mm. And so I'm looking at the differences in like one study where they did look head-to-head, and that was the study done at the Henry Ford Hospital that came out very recently, maybe sometime in June, I think, early July when I first saw that study. So it was a late comer, but it was the best of them in terms of its design, which made it more credible to me. And what they saw was a 66% reduction in risk of mortality with the hydroxychloroquine alone, and a 71% reduction if you threw in the azithromycin. So not even close to equal, right? Just a little incremental benefit. And because I'm a functional medicine doctor and I think the microbiome is very important, I don't give antibiotics very for preventative purposes. And I think that's philosophically wrong-headed. Mm-hmm. So in this situation, I think we'd need more trials, bigger trials, to really show that there's a substantially greater benefit. Because, of course, in conventional medicine, antibiotics are always good. They don't hurt people. They don't cause long-term dysregulation of the immune system. None of that exists. But I think it does. So sure. As a good gut gardener, I'm not going to give azithromycin lightly. So I have a bias. I want to be clear.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And one other thing I was curious about, because you mentioned this, and when I'm talking to people, I always talk about peer review, but I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm not really a scientist, but I try to, there's so much BS out there right now. I'm trying to like ground it. So this whole thing.
What the heck is peer review anyway, huh?
Yeah, what okay. is it? So there's, you know.
What is this?
Well, this Henry Ford study was panned by Dr. Fauci because it was a double blind trial study as opposed to a randomized placebo controlled. Mm-hmm. Maybe you talked about that in the beginning and I missed it. And if so, I'll just listen to the replay. But
it was randomized. It did have a placebo group. It was prospective. So these are, you know, hitting all of the things. I'm sorry, I didn't understand what Fauci's criticism is. I didn't hear
Fauci
it. So you'll
said,
have to
I'm
tell
just
me.
Reading again. An article. I pulled something up mm-hmm. to Fauci had called the study flawed in part because it was a double-blind trial study as opposed to a randomized placebo-controlled study. The doctors defended the study, arguing that the double-blind is the most well-accepted and definitive method. So I was a little confused just because...
Okay.
Yeah.
So can you... All right. So let me just say that Dr. Fauci is a political animal.
I have
great respect for him, but nobody survives through what is it now? Let's count. We've got Reagan. We've got Bush the first. We've got Clinton. We've got Bush the second. We've got Obama, and we've got Trump. That's six. Count them. Six presidents.
Yeah, I'm right? not like a. You know, oh, he's
no,
my hero.
No, this is not, you couldn't be a pure scientist and survive in this. No, I wanted to say that because you can criticize this study compared to the studies that got the FDA to pull it, which were retrospective, not prospective, no protocol, no fair comparison, records review study. And even the authors of the JAMA study said, well, you know, the groups that got the hydroxychloroquine were older, they were blacker, they had more diabetes, and they just ran down the list of all the things we know that make you more likely to die. And so those were the ones who got the hydroxychloroquine, and those were the ones who died. This proves right. nothing, right? They weren't comparable. And in terms of randomization, when you're in a hurry, what you do is you do every other person, you to the right, you to the left, you to the right, you to the left, you to the right, you to the left. You don't have time to, you know, if you're going prospective in a pandemic, you just have to have enough people that the various differences kind of come out in the wash. And I haven't seen, I think it's persuasive. I don't think it's definitive. It needs to replicate. But when I was reviewing this stuff, of the studies that I saw, with the exception of the Canadians, the study about a post-exposure prophylaxis, which I thought was reasonably well done, but I didn't like their method. That was a good study. And let's go back to your original question. What's peer review? So peer review is... I do my study, I submit it to the journal, the editors give it the once over, they say, oh, this looks decent. Then they send it out to a known expert in my field of virology, studying coronaviruses. Okay, there's maybe, let's say, 24 in the academic world all over the country who do that. And they all volunteer. They get these articles, they read them, and they're conscientious about it because they're actual scientists. And so they run the statistics, they look for mathematical errors, they look at the study design, they sniff around for inconsistencies, the way an auditor might look at someone's tax return. And it's like, huh, I noticed that you've got a loan for a large, you know, boat. And I'm wondering how you're paying for that, because, you know, that's the kind of thing that an auditor does, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they audit the study, and they may miss something, and you could always get through, you could always get away with lying if you're clever about it. The problem is nobody will be able to replicate your results, so you'll get outed in a year or two.
after three or four studies that tried to show that this was a thing, didn't show it was a thing. And so there's not much percentage in the long run in lying, although some people still do it for various reasons, but they'll usually get caught in the end. So peer review is a decent way of vetting the procedure. It's like when you get an employee application, you check their references, right? This is, you know, sort of the equivalent. Now, if you need somebody tomorrow because you just lost a critical person and somebody says, well, my Aunt Betty is a bookkeeper. Right. You're going to take Aunt Betty and you're not going to check Aunt Betty's references because you need that worker tomorrow. You're going to cut corners. And in the case of what's happened to the scientific literature since the pandemic, we just have stopped doing peer review because it takes too darn long. I mean, peer review delays an article for 6 to 12 months.
Okay.
Got it. 12 months in a pandemic. No bueno.
That's
so which is
really
the lesser of true evils?
Makes sense. I mean,
that's it.
Well, thank you. This is incredible. And I really appreciate the info because it's so politicized. And I think you and I are more on the left. And, you know, we're not supposed to talk about this drug as being positive. And it really is helpful to just hear the science.
Well, that's so just it. Science and politics don't mix.
Right.
And this is just such a good example of why they shouldn't mix. And if you really want to see science and politics in action, go read The Band Played On. I don't remember the name of the author. You sound young and you probably weren't even alive or, reading the newspaper in the early 80s, which is when this one played, when this one played out. But the early go and look at the AIDS epidemic. I can't call it. I guess you could call it a pandemic. I'm really not even sure what the difference is. But go look at the early days of AIDS when we didn't know what it was and we didn't know if it was respiratory and we didn't even know if it was a toxin or a virus. And I was in medical school during that era, so I was reading the science. And so this is deja vu all over again, as a famous man once said. And this time I'm in a better position to try and shed some light on it. So I'm doing my part.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. Have a wonderful day. Stay safe. And that mask, think of that mask as a shield that protects other people. And if everybody's wearing one, it's like one of these superhero things where, you know, if we put all of our power rings together, we become a giant robot. Well, if we all wear masks, we become invulnerable.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to go to an email. This was from Gay. Are diabetes 1 and 2 in the same level of high risk? And we're going to assume you mean for COVID. And so far as I have seen, they get lumped together, although I am sure that severity of the complications with an adult with type 1 diabetes, they're going to be more compromised. Typically, type 1 diabetes develops in childhood, and it adds by about 10 years. By the time you're an adult, you are 10 years older physically than you are chronologically. So the 30-year-old diabetic type 1 has the heart of a 40-year-old or a 45-year-old, the kidneys of a 45-year-old, and by the time they're 50, you can do the math. So you get chronically ill sooner because the even well-controlled type 1 diabetes really puts a strain on the organs. Type 2 diabetes is more variable in terms of its long-term effect because it depends on how well the person controls it. It's even reversible with diet in many people if they get a wake-up call when they're first diagnosed and make significant lifestyle behavioral changes. You can often be what we call a diet-controlled diabetic, which I don't even consider that to be a diabetic because you have normal blood sugar in the morning when you wake up and you have normal blood sugar after your meals. So the only thing that makes you diabetic is if I give you a massive if I give you a Coca-Cola, then your blood sugar will go above normal. Well, the answer to that is simple. You don't need drugs. You just need to avoid Coca-Cola. I would say that it's worse to have type 1 just because there's going to be more collateral damage from that in an adult. And with type 2s, if they're on insulin, they're going to have a bigger risk factor than if they're diet controlled. And it's a continuum, right? I don't think there have been many studies that have broken out, but that's just me applying logic to a situation where I think logic can be applied. We got a second question, DHEA and 5-HTP. What are these and when are they helpful for seniors? Okay, DHEA is a hormone, and it's part of the cortisol hormones, the so-called steroid, cortisol, sterol ring, steroid hormones. So that includes cortisol, it includes aldosterone, it includes DHEA, androstenedione, and as I keep going, now it's going to include testosterone and all of the three estrogens. So these are all some semi-interchangeable, and you can sometimes make one into the other. When people take DHEA, it's because we know it drops as we age, and it can favorably improve the testosterone and estrogen levels, so you can essentially do a little hormone replacement without actually taking testosterone or estrogen. It increases your muscle strength a little bit and is generally thought to be an anti-aging treatment. The nice thing about DHEA is it can be taken orally, and it actually gets it actually raises your DHEA levels. I do take about 25 milligrams of DHEA myself every day. I think it's very safe, obviously, or I wouldn't be taking it. And I have don't know, when I don't take it, I don't suddenly feel worse, but I wouldn't expect to with something that's being primarily taken as a preventative. 5-HTP is a precursor for serotonin. 5-hydroxytryptophan, it's often given as a sleep aid. It's helpful for getting some deep sleep. That gets harder as we age. So if the person is getting deep sleep and they're 70, I don't give them anything for it. 5-HTP might be something I would give them if they're having trouble. And let's see, we still have time. We had another email. All right, no, I think we can get it done. We've got about 7 minutes. So I don't know who this is from. It says, my lifelong male friend is going to need surgery for a thoracic aortic aneurysm. I believe it will be an open chest surgery. He is 75 years old and has scored in the 68th percentile pertaining to a cardiac calcium score. Also, he was early on diagnosed with a 70% blockage in an artery. I'm wondering in general how someone with the above mentioned comes through such a surgery. So appreciate your program. Well, okay. So your friend has some moderate risk factors for intraoperative complications. The 68th percentile on a calcium score means that he's basically close to the average for a 75-year-old man. And most 75-year-old men have a calcium score of something, and he's at the 50th percentile. He's a little above the 50th percentile for age, so that's not really any bigger a deal than being 75 years old in male. It's kind of a wash. We knew that. He has a 70% blockage in an artery. 70% blockage is not that bad. You'd expect to see some arterial blockage. Which artery would be significant? If it's in the front left anterior descending artery, that would be much worse than if it was in the, let's say, the circumflex artery, just because the place where you do not want your heart failure is your left ventricle. And if you were to have a heart attack in the left ventricle, it's much more serious than if you have a heart attack in the right ventricle or the right atrium or something like that. Those are just not as damaging to your physical functioning, and they're more survivable over the long term and less likely to lead to heart failure. So that being said, surgery, this is open chest, if he has open chest surgery, the recovery for this is very difficult, and I am not sure it's going to be open. I know that they are doing a lot of internal aneurysm repairs nowadays, and I believe they do ascending aorta, which would be the thoracic aorta. So that he may be having a a transvascular replacement, which is much safer, although they can be a little problematic in terms of leakage. They are way safer in terms of death to opening up the chest. If he does have an open procedure, his biggest risk post-op is going to be pneumonia, because he's going to have had his chest cut open and it's going to hurt a lot to breathe, and he's going to have a hard time coughing and clearing his airways. So his big risk is going to be, in the short run, is going to be pneumonia and failure of the graft, because, you know, this is, you're sewing something into the aorta, for goodness sakes. This is a non-trivial procedure. And most of his surgical risks relate to the surgery. The heart scores aren't that bad. I'd be really concerned more about how good are his lungs and whether he has any pulmonary disease or COPD. So I'd say your friend, I know you're worried, but I'd say that it may not be as bad as it appears on the initial face of it, not knowing the specifics of his case. If they didn't think they could get him through the surgery without him surviving, they wouldn't do the surgery. They just let him sit there. Would he have any extra risks because of COVID? No. They're really, really good at cleaning operating rooms, particularly operating rooms where you do open heart surgery or open chest surgery. So those areas are clean. The intensive care units, if there is a patient or one or two in the intensive care unit at any given moment in the hospital, they are sequestered. They're in a room with negative air pressure, which means that the air is getting sucked into their room. The other patients are screened and distanced. The hand washing and the gowning and the cleaning is very, very OCD in a circumstance like that. And so far, there have been I'm not sure there have been any cases of cross ICU contagion anywhere. I certainly have not heard about any. And given the levels of precaution that people are taking, we are not out of PPE here. So they're burning through it in this situation, as they should. Looks like we've come to very close to the end of the hour. I've got 2 minutes, maybe one for one cool little news of the weird, just to send you off. Goats have now been genetically engineered to produce a common cancer drug, which is actually a monoclonal drug. It's ceftuximab. It's used for bowel cancer. It costs about $5,000 a month per patient to treat cancer with this drug. However, researchers were able to put the gene into goat embryos that they then put into female goats, like impregnated them, you know, IVF, just like you do IVF in a human. The genetically modified goats were born 5 months later. They were all female, of course. And once they began lactating, they were producing 10 grams of this very expensive drug per liter in their milk. They make about 800 liters of milk a year. So that's going to be multiple kilograms of a very expensive drug that is given in milligrams. So if we could do that for a lot of our more expensive drugs, they'd be a lot more available. And I think this is going to be where we see drug therapy with these monoclonals going, is clone them into animals and milk the animals, because the milk is coming out, it's clean and really easy to purify. It's a bit different when you try to grow this in a bacteria vat or yeast. So I'm all for it. I hope you've enjoyed this. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.